Hello and welcome back. This is Victoria Duda from Zenith Lifestyle, bringing you the Metaphysical Podcast, episode 13, from the secret history of humanity. And where are we going? Today is a very special and rare occasion, because today is not just another full moon, but it's another blue moon. I'm sure you all heard that phrase from once in a blue moon, which we say when something is very rare. And I just learned that today one of these blue moons are occurring, which means we have an additional full moon that is not supposed to be there, that's not supposed to be in the calendar. So it's a term that refers to the fact that sometimes, in addition to the 12 full moons that we have in a year, we have a 13th. And we have it tonight, and we don't just have a 13th moon, but we also have a 13th episode. In which we have a little bit more chance to talk about the questions of metaphysics that we've been discussing over the last 12 full moons. And today I will ask probably the most important question at all, that if we're discussing metaphysics, where does that lead us? Where does it come from? And how does it become part of our lives? Do we just talk about these questions because they are interesting and they make a good conversation? I remember when I used to be at university, we used to drink wine and sit around and just talk about what is the meaning of life all night long, only to forget it by the next morning. And I think we've evolved beyond that. And we discuss these questions not just to entertain ourselves, but because they create changes in our lives. And today I want to talk a little bit about the continuity of that worldview. As we will see today, these metaphysical questions are not new at all. Even if today we talk a lot about a paradigm shift, so much so that it has become a word that we use in every household. Most people use it, I believe, without knowing what it actually means. And we talk about bringing in a new reality. But we hardly ever think of the fact that that actually might happen. If you don't believe in it, then just think of historic times when humanity had a worldview that was largely religious, even dogmatically religious. And it took a scientific revolution that we know today as the Copernican Revolution that changed all that. And because that changed, we have now a materialist scientific worldview. But it's, of course, not just a philosophical question. We wouldn't have most of the objects that we are using today in an everyday life, like a microphone that I record this on, a computer that I upload it on, the internet that allows you to listen to this, the car that allows you to go from one place to the other, or our buses and our planes and our ships and our electricity and even our weapons. But we wouldn't have any of that if it wasn't for a change in paradigm, a change shifting from one way to look at the world to another way to look at the world. So what I'm trying to say with that is that a shift in paradigm is actually creating real tangible changes in our everyday life. And I believe if we will have another change like that, that will include consciousness and it will include those metaphysical topics that we've been discussing in the scientific investigation, then we will have a change just as big. And I believe that the change is not going to be so much external, because we are going to just create our machines with the old paradigm just fine. But it's going to be a change that allows us to learn actual information about ourselves. So what will change is how we look at ourselves and our role in the universe. If you look back at history, we know that the metaphysical worldview was always out there. And I believe we actually had entire civilizations that were dedicated to it. When we look back at the ancient Egyptians, looking at their artifacts that they left behind in their buildings, we might just see that those people were fanatic about death. They were dedicating all their fantastic structures, their beautifully decorated and rich tombs. They were preparing people for eternity. So it's a superficial way to interpret that and say they had a cult of death. But of course, if you look at the same civilization from a different angle, from a more metaphysical angle, then we can see that the Egyptians paid so much attention to death because they saw the rebirth in it. They knew that the physical reality that we perceive with our senses is not the only reality. And when we die, then we have our consciousness that is going to be as important as now our bodies are. And they dedicated a large amount of their energies to educate people how to die and what to do after they died, how their consciousness can find a way in the afterlife. So they had their book of death that were describing the journey of the soul after death and what to do when the soul has to face judgment, when the soul has to continue journey, as the Egyptian book of death says, over millions and millions of years. So it was included that the soul undergoes an evolution, it incarnates over and over again, it dies over and over again, is born over and over again. Similarly, as we've seen previously in this podcast, the Tibetan culture is dedicating a lot of energy to understanding the inner workings of the mind. Therefore, if you go to Tibet, there is not much we can see in terms of buildings and in terms of technology. We can see the Potala Palace, which is great, but apart from that and the monasteries, there is not much tangible from that culture. But if we look at their scriptures and we read how much they knew about meditation, how much they knew how to leave the body, how to utilize dreams, how to survive the bardo state, then we see that the Tibetans were a culture dedicated to the inner workings of the mind. A very rich culture, probably the richest in the world, that knows the most about the mind. So it is worth to look at these cultures. It is worth to look at what has been preserved and to read what is left from their heritage. And, things like the Tibetan culture is, of course, still alive despite the tragedy of communist overtake, but the Dalai Lama is active and Tibetan Buddhism is active and luckily spreading in the West, so we have that as a living culture still. The Tibetan is different because it's been so long ago that we don't find any living Egyptian culture now. And what we just have left from studying their heritage is the wonderful, but only stones, only buildings and the hieroglyphical writings on these buildings. But actually, even those buildings can give us a lot more information than we might think. So it's a fascinating way to look at, for example, the Egyptian culture, how Swaller de Lubitz looked at it. He was an Orientalist and a mathematician, a philosopher at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. He died in 1961. An American Egyptologist, John West, took his theories and built on them. So you can look up his work and find some fascinating information about ancient Egypt. Because these two men, they looked at Egypt as a symbolic culture, as a culture working with symbols. And that is kind of like a key to understand their message. What is very interesting is that Swaller de Lubitz had looked at the temple at Luxor, and he found that if you look at the temple from above, then you can actually see that it looks like a schematic kind of outline of a human body, a mechanistic outline of the human body, like a map of the human body, if you want to put it like that. And it's interesting that if you start entering the temple, then it takes you through rooms, symbols and architectural bits and pieces that resemble the human body, but not so much its biological form, but the energetic form, the chakras, the hidden parts of the human body. So if you actually walk through the temple, you walk through the seven main chakras, and you see that the Egyptians were very much aware of the existence of a and, you know, bioenergies and bioenergetic bodies, because they were also aware that we have a part of us, we connect to this part of us with the subtle energies that is going to continue journey after death. So when we look at the symbolics in the temples, then we can see that they were actually a culture not so much obsessed with death at all, but with the eternity of life. And it's no surprise that in a culture like that, of course, there was a lot of philosophy going on, and there were schools dedicated to mysticism and dedicated to metaphysical issues. And we know that those schools existed because we have historic documents about them. But we also know because a lot of them survived. Of course, they changed over the centuries, but those Egyptian mystery schools that did exist in ancient Egypt, they have legacies that they left behind. And there are still societies today that claim to be descendants of the ancient Egyptian mystery schools, for example, the Freemasons or the Rosicrucians, that we know very well existed throughout European history. These societies, of course, were quite secret throughout history. They still exist today, but most of us know very little about them. There is less secrecy today, I believe, but for example, about the workings of the Freemasons, for a very, very long time, there was nothing to be known if you were not a member. Some pieces of art and music are really interesting because they tell us about these secret societies in forms that were tolerated at those times. One of the most salient examples is the Zauberflute, the magic flute of Mozart. The legendary Austrian composer, who was a Freemason, and not just him, but also Schikaneder, who wrote the libretto to the opera. They were Lodge brothers. And most people are familiar with the story of the magic flute or have seen the opera. And then if they look at it from a metaphysical, spiritual perspective, they can see that the entire story that's unfolding in the magic flute is actually an allegory to the growth and evolution, development of the human soul. So maybe you can recall, if you've ever seen the opera, is that it does have a queen of the night who is a dark character, a person that maybe can even resemble the Catholic Church, the Catholic Maria Theresia, the Austrian Empress of that time, when Mozart was around. So it has a little bit of a connotation of an enlightenment, more worldly power, but not spiritual power. And then antagonistic to her, there is Zarathustra, who's a enlightened sovereign and a enlightened ruler whose ruling is based upon reason, wisdom, nature. That is more the Enlightenment era. So these two figures, they show the kind of educational stages mankind go through, from chaos, from darkness, through religious superstition, up to an era of enlightenment. Also, the main characters in the opera, Papageno and Tamino, they are a little bit antagonistic to each other in terms of Papageno is a bird man. He symbolizes all the characters within a human mind that are coming from the animal realms. He's very much obeying his own desires and instincts and is not really looking into the higher realms of existence. On the other hand, Tamino is more listening to the higher calling and is more the refined part of human nature. But they both undergo trials throughout the story, and they both have to find their own salvation in order for humanity, for the human soul to reach evolution. So if I tell this today, it's fairly common knowledge. I'm probably not telling you anything new when I tell you that the human soul is evolving, but it was at that historic time something revolutionary that was so new that only members of secret societies were aware of it. And even they could only communicate that through pieces of art, through a language of symbols and music to, you know, let it come out and let big masses of people start to get equipped and acquainted with new ideas. Today, I believe that the time is ripe to open up this secrecy. I don't believe that we need more secret societies anymore. I think what we need is to get these ideas and to make them scientific, to find a scientific way to not just understand these principles, but also develop them further. Because these ancient philosophies that come from ancient Egypt, for example, they're well known under the phrase Hermetic philosophy. I will explain in a moment what we mean by that. But the point that I want to make clear is that they are not as far from modern science as we would maybe think. Because Hermetic philosophy, it comes from the word Hermes, Hermes Trismegistus, who is both a legendary figure that can be traced back to the Egyptian god of Thoth, who is a messenger of God or of the gods, who is a kind of figure. And we know that from the pyramid texts, that his job was when there was a deceased soul to take that soul, to ferry that soul through across into the underworld. So he was a kind of psychopomp, a kind of guide to the souls. But he also became, after the Egyptian times, he became a kind of legendary teacher, the three times great Hermes, the Hermes Trismegistus, who, you know, sometimes he thought never died, who was always there or is always there throughout history. But basically, he stands for the wisdom that comes from the original times, a kind of wisdom that doesn't change throughout the ages, that is not dependent on society changes, it's not dependent on particular religious ideas, it's not dependent on history, economics, people's taboos and people's understandings of reality, but it is an eternal philosophy that says that there is just one God, one all, one universe. And because it's all one, God, who the religions refer to as God, is not actually a kind of personalized being who exists apart from humanity or apart from nature. You know, in the eternal philosophy, God is just standing for the fact that consciousness, that the creative force in the universe is eternal and is the fundamental force in the entire universe. And we as human beings are actually part of it. We are not separate from it. We participate in God's adventure. So in that level, the question whether we believe in God or we don't believe in God becomes completely obsolete because it is so big, the concept, that it entails everything. We can just say the all, the everything. But it does imply that that everything, that one, that all, is a kind of consciousness that we also possess, but that has the power to create the entire universe. So that consciousness is a fundamental power in the universe that we are part of, that we participate. As above, so below is a very common Hermetic sentence, which does imply the same thing. It says, we are here below on the planet Earth. We are having a human experience. But what we experience and what we learn also applies above, also applies in the realm of the gods or in the realm of the human superego, if you want to put it like that. So it does apply to the collective consciousness just as much as it applies to the individual consciousness. So maybe you can see from here that this kind of worldview is so different from the science that we have today, precisely because it allows our consciousness to have a fundamental role in the universe. Because if our consciousness is the same type of consciousness that is fundamental in the universe, that had a creative power once upon a time to create the universe, and that creative power is still ongoing, then our consciousness has that creative power. Then it does matter what we think, because it is through our own thoughts that the universe is evolving into something that it will become tomorrow. So if you compare two things, science, the materialistic science of today, and the eternal philosophy of the Hermetic wisdom, then you will see that science today is actually saying something pretty bleak. I'm going to, not word by word, but quote Jonathan Black, who wrote The Secret History of Humanity, and in that book he said that science today wants us to believe that there is no point to our thoughts and our feelings. He actually says that there is no point crying out to heavens in the hour of our greatest anguish, because all we will find out there is an indifferent material universe. That the stars can only show us indifference. That nature can only show us indifference. That the human task is just to grow up, to mature into understanding that there is this basic indifference, that it doesn't matter, and that our lot is to be annihilated upon death. That is what our present materialistic science offers as a worldview. Now, psychologically speaking, that worldview is disempowering. But compare that to the worldview of the eternal philosophy that says if we take consciousness as fundamental in the universe, then so is our own consciousness. And if our consciousness has a creative power, then it is actually up to our consciousness to change the evolution of not just our race, but the universe as such. So think about it, whether you today choose a thought that is positive, that is working towards heaven, that is working towards an existence that is based on happiness, then you will bring that reality into existence. If you are thinking thoughts that are bleak and that are depressing and that are directed towards annihilation, then it is precisely that annihilation that you will bring upon, not just yourself, but the world around you. So what this creates is a sense of immense responsibility that is not just a responsibility that a lot of people want to actually shy away from, but it's also a fascinating type of possibility. And if we begin to use that possibility, then something is required of us, something that not a lot of people can always bring up. Something that a lot of people would rather avoid and go and watch television instead, that a lot of people would hide away from. Because what is required from us is courage. Courage to stand up against a very nihilistic and very sarcastic worldview and to say that I believe different. And I believe different even if you say that my thinking is a wishful thinking, that I'm only fantasizing and making this up, because the answer to that can be that, yes, I am fantasizing and I'm making this up, but because my power is to create through my thoughts, by fantasizing and wishfully thinking that, I'm actually bringing it into existence. And that, of course, is a task that is not easy to put into practice. And I believe that apart from courage, what can help us is to see that we are not alone. That if you are listening to this podcast, you are one of the people who want to bring up on that change. Then you are someone who already believes. And there is one more step to take that belief out into the world and share it with others. And because I know that that is not an easy task, and I know that we need all the help that we can get and all the community that we can get, I am closing this podcast now, but at the same time, I'm opening a new podcast series. And that podcast series will be called Multidimensional People, because I am going to go out there and I'm going to talk to people, find people and talk to people who have already made that change and who have learned to live in multiple dimensions, who have learned to live in the visible and in the invisible world simultaneously, and who will tell us a little bit about their secrets, how they've done it. And we all can create together, be together, and learn from each other. And I very much hope that you will tune into that as well. Looking forward to your company again. And in the meantime, have a lovely time, and I see you again at the next full moon. Thank you for listening, and bye-bye for now.